Chapter 23, Excursus on Corruption in the Judiciary. In October 2019, CAS convened a workshop in Durban to concentrate the attention of delegates on the thorny issues that relate to corruption in the judiciary. A year later, the same topic was ventilated in detail at a SADC lawyers conference. The workshop complements the topics covered in the earlier conferences and workshops. Since Roman times, the question, who guards the guardians, quis custodiet ipsos custodes, has been posed as a challenge to the rule of law and the fair administration of justice. The long-established rules require that judges be imbued with the qualities of impartiality, independence, and integrity. Systems need to be designed with these qualities in mind. Those who do not measure up to the exacting standards of the three I's ought not to be appointed to the bench. If some are inadvertently so appointed, mechanisms must be in place to counter the deleterious effects their presence on the bench can and does have. Strategies need to be put in place to prevent and deter corrupt and errant behavior in judges. There can be no gainsaying that the activities of corrupt judges are an inevitable blight on any system intended to deliver fair outcomes to those involved in disputes, whether criminal or civil. The undermining of integrity and impartiality through the appointment of judges who are regarded by the executive as a safe pair of hands or executive-minded is the start of the rot that has accompanied the decline of many countries in Africa and around the world. Just as politicians should take office to serve the people they represent, judges are solemnly obliged to uphold the law and the Constitution that they are bound to defend by their oaths of office. One of the measures in the World Justice Project's Rule of Law Index is called Absence of Corruption in the Judiciary. Absence of corruption in the judiciary is in turn one of the 64 features of governance that is used in compiling the index. The spider graphs that are published by the World Justice Project keep track of the levels of judicial corruption as perceived by the experts and laypeople who are interviewed by the WJP researchers each year as they compile the index. Trends are discernible from time to time. Overall, the judiciary tends to fare better than legislatures and executive branches of government, but there is no cause for complacency. The Rule of Law Index can be viewed in its latest form on the website of the World Justice Project. The judiciary is factor 2.2 on the Absence of Corruption scorecard. The best way to prevent the rot is to put in place an appropriate appointment procedure that is operated by personnel and officials imbued with the qualities one seeks in all judges. An independent, impartial body that has decision makers of integrity is the ideal starting point for ensuring that judges who are appointed by it or on its recommendation are capable of living up to the standards expected of them by the rule of law. The key to success in the judicial appointments process is to ensure that the body making the appointments goes about its work transparently, accountably, and in a manner that is responsive to the public need for an independent and impartial judiciary. It is preferable to exclude politicians from membership of the appointments body. Where this is politically impossible, the influence of politics in the appointments body should be kept to a minimum. Candidates should succeed on merit and be fit and proper persons for all roles in the judiciary. Fidelity to the rule of law and constitutionalism is what the law requires of judges, not fealty to some or other political agenda. Ideally, the workings of the appointments body should be presided over by retired judges of good standing with civil society and business leadership, faith-based organizations, labor, the legal professions and academia all contributing their voices to the decision-making process. A small sifting committee, imbued with the necessary expertise and authority, should be chosen from within the appointments body. The sifting committee should be tasked with checking the credentials of applicants and with arranging for psychometric testing of all applicants who survive the sifting process. Those applicants who pass the psychometric tests and a call for public input on their pedigrees must then subject themselves to participation in a public interview process. In this way, chances do not get past the sifting committee, and the psychometric testing weeds out those psychologically unsuited for the duties of the judiciary. Public input could reveal dark skeletons of the past, and the diligence of the sifting committee brings about a happy situation in which the most meritorious applicants make it to the interview stage. Too often, the appointments process is in the hands of amateurs and politicians. Psychometric testing of aspirant judges is unheard of, even though it is widely used in the business sector before senior appointments are made. The politicization of the selection process does the rule of law no favors. The idea of creating a special body, call it the Commission for Senior Appointments and Disappointments, to preside over the selection of judges, leaders of the prosecution service, and senior personnel in the police, among others, has been put forward by retired Deputy National Director of Public Prosecutions, Willie Hofmeyr, in South Africa. It is an idea worth pursuing, as it holds the prospect of a more professional and less politically charged process for finding the most meritorious candidates of integrity to perform the ponderous work demanded of an independent, impartial judiciary. At the workshop in Durban, the retired Chief Justice of Zambia, Ernest Sakala, delivered the keynote address. In it, he stressed that the independence of the judiciary is important for the proper administration of justice. Independence serves the right of all persons to a fair adjudication of their disputes. Independence should not merely be regarded as an insulator for the judiciary. It is through independent adjudication of disputes that the people receive proper delivery of their right to a fair trial or unbiased adjudication of their civil disputes without fear, favor, or prejudice. The next business of the workshop was to receive country reports from delegates familiar with the state of play in their countries. Reports were received on the situation as regards judicial corruption in several African countries, which included Malawi, Uganda, Kenya, Zambia, Botswana, Namibia, and South Africa. It is possible to extract a few overarching themes from the discussions that the country reports elicited. The first theme related to the phenomenon known as state capture. It appears that the culture of corruption with impunity is facilitated and fueled by the capture of the Criminal Justice Administration. As the work of the Criminal Justice Administration is done by police investigators, specialized prosecutors, and judges who sit in cases involving grand corruption, it makes perfect but crooked sense for the kleptocrats to protect themselves against police investigation, prosecution, and punishment by the courts. The protection is secured via state capture. This phenomenon has been defined as the efforts of a small number of people aiming to benefit from the illicit provision of private gains to public officials in order to profit from the workings of a government. Or more succinctly, state capture is a type of systemic political corruption in which private interests significantly influence a state's decision-making processes to their own advantage. South Africa and Hungary are regarded as the prime current examples of attempts at state capture. Clearly, no properly functioning judiciary should be prone to capture of this kind. The fact that the South African judiciary consistently makes findings that do not favor the kleptocrats in that country suggests that the capture of the state in South Africa does not extend to the judiciary. There are, however, telltale signs that some in the judiciary share the transformational vision of the ANC rather than that of the Constitution itself. These have manifested themselves in the judgments concerning language and cultural rights, the right to ownership of minerals, and the less attractive features of the decision in Glenister 3, which has been discussed elsewhere in this book. When state capture proceeds to the point at which the judiciary does the bidding of the executive, a future of Zimbabwean kind beckons. That dire fate ought to awaken resistance to the capture of any state. Executive-mindedness in judges was also identified as a problem. The executive prefers to have judges with this type of outlook. If the executive plays a large role in the appointment of judges, it can be expected that executive-minded judges will be appointed. The ideal is to have an objective appointments body appointing lawyers' lawyers to the judiciary, those who will scrupulously hold themselves to the standards of the law and the Constitution in their deliberations and judgments. In some jurisdictions, an over-concentration of power in the office of the Chief Justice has led to mischief that could be avoided if suitable checks and balances on the exercise of power are put in place. Even Chief Justices should not be left without checks and balances on the exercise of their powers. All too frequently, ambiguous and vague terminology is used to describe the powers of opaque disciplinary bodies which are meant to stand guard over the probity of the judiciary. While it is so that it should not be an easy matter to discipline a judge, the system for disciplinary steps should not be so convoluted and loaded against a complainant as to make it almost impossible to have a disciplinary complaint properly and fairly adjudicated. The perception of a closing of ranks must be avoided. For sitting judges to sit in judgment of the alleged misconduct of their colleagues creates complications in the disciplinary process best avoided by using retired judges in the adjudicative roles. The enormous inequalities that exist in systems of discipline tend to load the dice in favor of the judges complained of rather than the complainant. It is expensive to obtain legal relief in ordinary litigation. In litigation against judges, the complainant is left all too often with the feeling that the entire system is so designed that the scales of justice tip in favor of the judge whose misconduct is under scrutiny. There is an infamous exchange between two senior judges who were sitting together on a disciplinary panel constituted to ascertain, among other things, whether a judge president arraigned to appear before them was a tax evader. Part of the exchange took place during a break in proceedings when the judges were unaware that the recording machine was faithfully continuing to do its work. The exchange is recorded in a longer report which is available on the Accountability Now website. The extract relevant to the complaint laid by a small opposition party, the African Christian Democratic Party, is as follows. The fourth question from the ACDP aimed at possible tax evasion, read, was any additional income received by the judge president disclosed by him in his income tax returns? In other words, has there been transparency on the part of Judge Schlorpy in his dealings with the tax man? This is an important question, as tax evasion is a crime involving dishonesty. It was also perfectly legitimate for the ACDP to raise it and to expect to have it properly investigated and answered fully. No judge who commits a crime of this nature is competent to continue in office. This is how the possibility of tax evasion is dealt with in the questioning of Judge Schlorpy on the 13th of September 2006 by a special committee of the Judicial Service Commission consisting of President Craig Howie, Judge President Ngwepe, and Seth Ntai, Senior Counsel. Howie P., did you declare it, the Oasis income? Schlorpy JP, to the best of my knowledge, sir, my tax is up to date, and I brought proof thereof. Howie P., my question was, did what you declare include the remuneration from Oasis? Schlorpy JP, I don't remember what was the arrangement between myself and Oasis with regard to tax in particular, but I have not had any queries raised from the tax authorities. Howie P., would you just check? We don't want tax details that don't have anything to do with this. The question is simply whether the receipts from Oasis were declared. Schlorpy JP. Okay. At a later stage in the proceedings, in an exchange between Ngwepe JP and Howie, whilst Schlorpy JP is not present, the former, apparently unaware that the recording equipment is faithfully doing its work, has the following to say. The reference to the tax returns, I don't know where that is going to lead. That, which may be something else altogether, I was becoming quite uncomfortable about such direction, because what if somebody hears that he has not disclosed that in his tax returns, which means a criminal offence, and really? Howie P. responds, that is not a complaint. It is abundantly clear from paragraph 4 of the ACDP complaint set out above that possible tax evasion is indeed a complaint. The passage above shows that Judge Schlorpy has assiduously avoided directly answering the questions asked of him by President Howie, and that the latter has been closed down on this line of questioning by an uncomfortable Judge President Ngwepe. In their discussion during the proceedings on 13th September 2006, an edited version of which appears in this book. To make matters considerably worse, it also emerges that Judge Schlorpy used the vehicle of a trust, the TNG Trust, to accept receipt of the income from Oasis earned by him. He is not asked why, and that, in his own words, in a follow-up letter of 13th July 2007, he says, my application for tax amnesty is currently pending before the South African Revenue Service with regard to some income which was not timely declared. I am currently awaiting the outcome of this application. On the record made available by the Judicial Service Commission, absolutely no effort of any kind is made to investigate any of this startling information. There is no amnesty available in respect of income tax not timely declared. The income to which Judge Schlorpy refers in the passage quoted above from his letter to the Judicial Service Commission is apparently his Oasis income. It is perhaps speculation to suggest that the Oasis income was not declared until after its existence was made public by Newsweek magazine. If the Judicial Service Commission had properly investigated the ACDP complaint about possible tax evasion, the need for such speculation would fall away. As matters stand, there is doubt as to whether or not the Judge President of the Cape is a tax evader, like Al Capone, and as to whether he only came clean when exposed by Newsweek magazine. This is unacceptable. The questions asked by President Howie ought, in the public interest, to be properly and fully answered. The so-called application for tax amnesty by Judge Schlorpy, to which the Judicial Service Commission turned a blind eye, ought to be made public so that the relevant timeline and nature of the income not timely declared can be made known. It can certainly not be his judicial salary, for this is subject to a pay-as-you-earn deduction at source. If it is other outside income, not from Oasis, the public is fully entitled to know about it and its origin. If it is Oasis income, which was not declared until after publicity was accorded to the goings-on between Judge Schlorpy and Oasis, the inference of tax evasion becomes irresistible. This is especially so as the Oasis accounting records refer erroneously to receipts by the Ting Trust of the money earned by Judge Schlorpy. On the available evidence, the question posed by the ACDP is still wide open, which is a most unsatisfactory outcome. The exchange recorded in the passage quoted above is evidence supporting the complaints by delegates to the workshop held in Durban that the mechanisms for adjudicating complaints against judges are weak in some jurisdictions, as illustrated above, and absent in others. Those who guard the guardians should themselves be fulsomely independent, scrupulously impartial, and unbending in their integrity. Judge President Schlorpy was evidently not properly investigated as a tax evader. Some years later, it came back to haunt the disciplinary structures of the South African judiciary when he became involved in an ongoing spat with all of the justices of the Constitutional Court over his attempts to influence the outcome of a case in which then-aspirant President Jacob Zuma featured as a litigant. Since then, Zuma has served two terms as President of South Africa, but the disciplinary steps against Schlorpy trundle on at a snail's pace. Judge President Schlorpy now stands accused in January 2020 by his deputy of attempting to put pro-Zuma judges onto the bench determining a review of the Russian nuclear power plant procurement process. He did not succeed, and he denies the accusations of impropriety on his part. If he was serving in Botswana or Namibia, the digitization of the allocation of matters for hearing in the courts would have rendered it impossible for him to steer the review matter towards those whom he perceived to be executive-minded members of the bench, those sympathetic to ex-President Zuma. The digitization removes the allocation decision-making process from human agency, thereby removing the temptation to stack the bench against a pesky litigant. It is relevant to this long-standing saga to note that had the Schlorpy affair taken place in Kenya, the rules there require that the disciplinary inquiry be finalized within 6 months. In June 2020, the Shadow Minister of Justice in South Africa, Advocate Glynis Breytenbach, wrote about the Schlorpy affair in the media in the following terms. The Judge President of the Western Cape High Court, John Schlorpy, who was appointed to lead the bench in 2000, has had a career overshadowed by a variety of controversies. This is something that should never become a behavioral norm for one who pronounces judgment in our courts. The judiciary needs to be seen to uphold the laws, not just in court, but also in all aspects of life, and be seen to be free from bias or favor. Judges must be persons of integrity, independence, and impartiality. One of the controversies surrounding Schlorpy is his alleged attempt to unduly influence Constitutional Court Justices Bess Nkabindi and Chris Jafta to find in favor of Jacob Zuma and the Tint Company in an appeal in 2008. This complaint has yet to be dealt with some 12 years later. But even prior to that,